Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Sedekase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. This episode is another very special one. I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Nick Effingham, and we're going to be talking about time and time travel. This is a professional podcast, you know, like we're not going to make jokes about, you know, going Effingham on time travel or anything like that. That maybe someone else can do that. We're above that here. So we're not going to make any jokes about that. But I'm really excited. Usually we talk about a paper or a book. But Dr. Effingham has so much stuff on this that I just took a bunch of concepts from a smattering of his papers and books. So I'm really excited. We're going to be talking about like some ontologies of time, different theories of time travel, like what would have to be true if time travel were possible and you could change the past, all that good stuff. So definitely stay tuned if you want to become an expert on time and time travel. Before we jump in, though, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon. If you guys like this podcast, if you've benefited from it, if you learned some stuff, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can join for like as little as $3 a month, all the way up to, well, there's a bunch of different levels and you get different perks. I think it's all the way up to $100. But I want to do this for a living. So please, if you have benefited from it, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. There's a lot of other ways to support the podcast as well. You can find the super thanks down here, super thanks button. You can buy merchandise, all sorts of good stuff. I hate commodifying myself, but I have done it with every aspect of my life. You can buy merchandise that looks like my dog even. So without, there's ways to do that. Check the description. But let's jump in on time and time travel with Dr. Nick Effingham.
Hi.
Dr. Effingham, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's excellent to be here.
Yeah, this is awesome. Before we jump in on some of the particulars of your work, I'm just curious, how'd you get into philosophy in the first place?
So for me, it's just a comedy of errors for me. So I wanted to go to university and do English and become an author and all this kind of thing. I didn't even know what philosophy was back in, well, this would be in the 1990s. 1990s middle class Britain, you didn't do philosophy. No one, I didn't know people even really knew what philosophy was. But I filled in the form. We had a form to go to university. It's called an UCAS form. And you filled it in, and there's a number of slots that you needed to fill up to go to university. So I filled up about 3 of them with my English courses. And my parents at the time insisted that all 5 or 6 were filled up. They were like, you can't have blank spaces. That's not allowed. So I sat down and I flipped. They had a big book of what courses you could do. And I flipped through. And when I got to English and philosophy, I actually remember, I could be a philosopher. Didn't know what one was. I was like, yeah. Never thinking I was going to do it because I thought I was going to do straight English. My exam results, you have what are called mock A levels, and they determine which university you go to. And my mock A levels I did shortly during the time that I met my first 16-year-old girlfriend. And, you know, that I didn't advise for exams. None of that happened. It was just the normal tale of adolescent getting carried away. So I didn't get onto the straight English courses. I got onto the English and philosophy course. Turns out I hate English, just all of it. Degree level English, just can't stand any of it. Loved philosophy, and I went into philosophy. And there we go.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's awesome. Well, okay. So then even in philosophy, you're like a specialist in time and time travel.
Yeah.
How'd that come about?
During my time as a PhD student, my PhD was in ontology and the ontology of physical objects. And I'm still very much interested in ontology. I'm still very much interested in these things. But I did also have an interest in time travel. And I can't remember exactly why. One or two things came up at the same time when I was in the University of Leeds. And I said, hey, guys, we could do a leading group on the philosophy of time travel. And this, because I quite like time travel. I'd always been into sci-fi and Doctor Who, and I love reading popular science books on how to make time machines out of wormholes. So it just seemed natural to do a leading group on it. And then the leading group with Jonathan Robson led to my first publication. And that was on time travel. That was 2007. And once you've started the ball rolling and you've led a bit of time travel, you just end up doing more and more and more.
Yeah, that's awesome. I thought maybe we could broach the topic of time and time travel with a really simple question. Just what is time?
What is time?
Super simple, super easy.
Super easy. Yeah. So it's a difficult question now because you could mean so many different things. So,
right.
Time is a dimension like space that orders what goes on in it. So you've got spatial orderings. I can drop lots of objects into different spaces, and you've got things from left to right of one another. That's the ordering. Time is like that. You can scatter objects throughout time, and some things are earlier than some things and later than some things. So that might be what time is. But usually when people are asking that question, I don't think that's the kind of thing they've got in mind. But pinning down exactly what someone has in mind when they're asking questions like that, that's part and parcel of figuring out, you know, what kinds of questions you're looking at in the philosophy of time.
Right. So in getting into like the ontology of time and stuff, would a presentist say that time is a dimension, or do they say, would they have to say like, no, time is just something that we do when we measure the movement of things or something?
I mean, if you ask me, so the presentists, they believe that only the present moment exists, and yet nevertheless, I think they probably should still think that time is adequately described as being a dimension. So,
okay,
even though these other things don't exist, it still makes sense to imagine that things could be stuck in that dimension. How to think of it? Imagine you didn't believe in numbers. In numbers. It would nevertheless make sense for you to talk about the number two being smaller than the number four. There are no such things as numbers, you would say, but you can still think they stand in these relations, in these orderings. And I think even if you're a presentist, you should think that these events, remember, there are no non-present events, but these events that don't exist, they still stand in this ordering in some sense. There might be a deeper metaphysical explanation of what's going on when it comes to philosophy of time that has nothing to do with that. But that again goes to this question that when you ask, what is time? I'm not entirely sure we're exactly sure what that question means. And not in an interest.
Right.
There's no philosophical question about what that question means. There's just lots of different questions that I find some people think tallies with the question, what is time?
Yeah. Okay. My audience will be familiar with this, but it might be worth just a quick like overview of presentism, eternalism, or four dimensionalism, moving spotlight, growing block, and wave. Your wave is the one I really want to dive in with you. So can you just help us out with like presentism, eternalism, moving spot, and growing block?
Sure. It's probably easiest to start with eternalism. So this entire debate, and some people, as I'm about to get stuck into it, as with many things in metaphysics, some people think this entire debate is a load of nonsense. Like, just none of it makes any sense. We're just making terms. And I'm comfortable with that being an issue. So that is an issue, and we do need to say something about that. And I do think the debate does make sense, but, you know, be aware, some people think it's just nonsense. So the best way to start getting your head around this debate and what we might call temporal ontology, the questions about what exists in the past and what exists in the future, is to discuss eternalism. So eternalists, they think that time is a lot like space. So right here, right now, I'm in Birmingham, UK, but it makes sense for me to say that the Eiffel Tower exists. Right? The Eiffel Tower, it's in France. It's in France. It doesn't exist here. It doesn't exist here. It doesn't exist in Birmingham, UK. It exists in Paris, Europe. The eternalist thinks time is a lot like space in that respect. The outposts on Mars that we'll eventually build in 2700 AD, they exist. They just don't exist now. Yeah. Napoleon Bonaparte, he still exists. He's still invading Russia. He just isn't doing it now. He's doing it back in the past. He's doing it separated. So they think that temporal separation is just like spatial separation. The things still exist. They're still there. They just aren't local. They're not spatio-temporally local. They don't exist now. So that's how the eternalist sees the world. The world, if God was looking at the world, God would see all of the four-dimensional reality before him. God could see the dinosaurs and see the outposts on Mars all at the same time from his external point of view. The presentist, they differ. They either think this debate makes no sense, and therefore the only things that exist presently exist. Or they think the debate makes sense, the question's a good one, but the answer is that only the presently existing things exist. So you've got kind of two types of presentist. one who rubbishes the debate, one who goes, no, this debate is very serious, but presentism's still true. So that's okay. The presentist view. Napoleon doesn't exist in any sense. The outposts on Mars don't exist in any sense. They will exist. Napoleon did exist. But that's different from existing. So there are the two main views. There's a third view. There's a fourth view, which is my view, but there's a third main view as well, which has been often discussed, which is the growing block view. And that's the idea that things from the past and the present exist, but not the future. So reality is this block that keeps growing. As the present moment moves on, what exists gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's a growing block view. Yeah, so they're the three views.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is I want to broach wave theory, but I don't. Maybe I should hold back. But is wave theory a type of moving spotlight?
So moving spotlight. So that this goes into a different dimension of the debate. So we've got this question about what exists. This question about what exists. You got eternalism, presentism, going block. But there's another question that isn't ontological. It doesn't concern what exists. It concerns what the world is like. It is metaphysical, but it's not ontological. And this is the idea that is the world fundamentally tensed, or is the world fundamentally tenseless? So if the world was fundamentally... So we can imagine that when we're describing the world, some descriptions are more fundamental than other descriptions. So Nick Effingham exists. That's a good description. But Nick Effingham's there are atoms arranged in a certain way. That seems to be a more fundamental description. And if that fundamental description is true, then that first thing is true. If you've got atoms arranged like this, you've got Nick Effingham. So Nick Effingham exists is true, but it's not fundamentally true. So the idea is that once you accept that some propositions, some statements, some claims are fundamentally true, we can ask whether it's fundamentally true that it's now 2022, that it was the case 205 years ago that Russia was invaded by Napoleon, that it will be the case in 500 years' time that there's outposts on Mars. Those claims are definitely true. Who would deny them? No one. You'd have to be mad to think that it's not currently 2022. If a philosopher tells you that's not true, that philosopher needs to sit down and have a break. But there's a question about whether it's fundamentally true. So the tense theorists say it's fundamentally true. These tense facts, it was tense fact, the case that Napoleon invaded Russia. That's fundamentally true. The tenseless theory says that this isn't the case. The tenseless theorist, who is always an eternalist, the tenseless theorist says, look, God makes the world, and there's no tense facts. If you phone up God and go, hey, God, is it presently 2022? God will be like, no, that question makes no sense. You may as well phone me up going, is Birmingham here, or is Paris here? And God will be like, well, where are you? Like, here's where, that depends on where you are. This isn't a fundamental question that God answers. That's a derivative fact. You find out where here is a derivative fact based upon your location, the location of where you're at. So the tenseless theorists, they agree that it's now 2022. They agree that Napoleon did invade Russia 200 years ago. But they say that those statements are true in virtue of non-tensed facts. Yeah. Namely, facts like Napoleon exists, Nick Effingham exists, Napoleon invading Russia is 202 years earlier than. So that's a temporal statement, earlier than, but it's not tensed. Was is tensed, earlier than is tenseless. And it's those facts that mean that it was the case that Napoleon invaded Russia. So that's the difference between tensed and tenseless. You've got that. So we've got two dimensions of debate. We've got what exists and what's the world fundamentally like. You can mix and match them. You can't mix and match tenseless theory with anything other than eternalism. I mean, there'll be some philosophers. There's philosophers out there who believe you can. Philosophers believe crazy things.
That's right.
Like, you can't. Like, they're long. So One of the options is tenseless eternalism. There's no tenseless presentism. There's no tenseless going block. Because if presentism was true, there would be a fundamental fact about what was now. You'd sort of look around you and go, right, these things are now. If you're presentist, you're tense theorist. If you're going block theorist, you're tense theorist. But there is one crossover. Okay. You could be an eternalist, like the tenseless theorist, you could be an eternalist. You could think that all of these things exist, that Napoleon exists, the outposts on Mars exist, that I exist. But you could be a tense theorist. There's still like an extra ingredient that God has to sprinkle into reality. So God makes the eternal four-dimensional block. But God has to sprinkle in the one of the times is special. The one of the times is different, fundamentally so. The one of the times is present. So that's moving spotlight. That's moving spotlight.
Okay.
And that's become quite popular. Ross Cameron, they think it's got some legs.
Yeah, so I really like moving spotlight because you can just point to like YouTube. So some people will be watching this on YouTube, and you can look at the whole timeline of this video, but you also see the little counter going where we're talking right now, where they're listening, and you could move it back and you can move it forward, but they're not all playing at the same time because that would be insane. You wouldn't be able to understand anything, and
reality is a lot like that on the moving spotlight thing.
Yeah, but then the hard thing is like motivating, like why think that, and like, well, maybe because God's watching the YouTube video of reality, and you're like, well, yeah, I don't know. That's so. How do people? I guess what do you think of moving spotlight, and are there like how would people motivate it?
So there's some good questions about what motivates these different theories, and actually, I'm starting to suspect that there's quite a dearth of motivations for being a tenseless theorist and a dearth of motivations for being a tense theorist. So I think it's difficult to decide which one you should be. Traditionally, people have thought that we'd argue for eternalism. Eternalism pairs up with tenseless theory, so we're done. But it's become quite obvious now that with moving spotlight theory and other theories which are similar, like my own theory, wave theory, there's tense theories that seem to have like this eternalist flavor. So I can give you good arguments for being an eternalist. Can I give you good arguments for being a tense theorist or tenseless theorist? Gets a bit tricky. Mm-hmm. Usually the argument is to do with experience. The idea is that, you know, don't you feel like this is the present moment? And isn't the only way to really explain that is that one of these moments is special, that you do live in the present moment. The tense theory is true. But I've never thought much of that argument. And if you read the literature, having read the literature, I think the people who say this argument doesn't work, they sound like. So I don't think we've got a good argument for tense theory. Then I don't think we've got a good argument for tenseless theory either. So, you know, what should we do? We should go off and do some research and develop both theories, see where they lead. And hopefully that gives an indication of which one's true and which one's false.
Right. Well, so then you come along and you give us wave theory. It's a new theory of temporal ontology.
Yeah.
Can you help? Okay, so maybe going back to the axis, right? Like, where is wave theory on? Is it? It's a new theory of temporal ontology. So this would be a competitor to like growing block and presentism and eternalism.
Yeah. So it's a fourth answer. And it gets to be a fourth answer because you would have thought that I'd kind of exhausted all of the options. You've got the past, the future, and the present, and you just tick which one exists. You've got to say the present exists. Who would believe the present doesn't exist? If you think the past, present, and future exist, you're an eternalist. If you think the future doesn't exist and the past and present do, you're going block theorist. And there's an extra theory called thinking block, which is that the future exists and the present exists, not the past. But, you know, who genuinely believes that? No one genuinely believes that.
Okay.
So you would have thought that exhausts all of the options, but I kind of think it doesn't. So wave theory plays on the idea that plays on a dip. So what wave theory has done, it's taken two things in metaphysics and slapped them together. So it's taken a debate in temporal ontology, which we've just talked about, and it slaps it together with a debate that we haven't talked about, which is material constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just quickly say something about that. We won't get too in-depth into that because it'll pull us off the beaten path.
Yeah.
But it's a big thing. It's a big thing in ontology, is that there's this question about material constitution. That if I have a lump of clay and I shape it into the form of a statue, how many objects have I got? Mm-hmm. And the intuition is that you've only got one object. But the problem with that is that if you've got one object, then the lump of clay, well, that existed for a longer period of time than the statue. The statue only came into existence when you shaped the lump of clay into a statue. So the statue and the lump of clay, they've got different properties. The statue's existed since midday. The lump of clay has existed for weeks. And if they've got different properties, they can't be the same thing.
Right.
So you've got at least two things. And this is the basis of a lot of ink has been spilt on this question. Mm-hmm. One of the popular answers, I'm not saying it's the only answer, but one of the popular answers is that the lump of clay is distinct from the statue. There are two different things there. It's just that the lump of clay constitutes the statue. Once you see that some objects can constitute other objects, this problem becomes a whole lot less weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a different debate, and I'm gonna smoosh you with the temple ontology debate.
Okay.
So imagine you've got, just like the Eternalist says, you go, what exists? The Eternalist says, well, there's all these four-dimensional hunks of matter. And what's Nick Effingham? Nick Effingham is one of those four-dimensional hunks of matter. He's this one. And Napoleon's this one. The outposts on Mars are these four-dimensional hunks over here. So the wave theorist says, I like the sound of these hunks. I believe in them. So like the Eternalist, they believe that there's these four-dimensional hunks of matter back in the past and in the future and like now. But they deny that the hunks are the everyday objects. So the Eternalist said, that hunk is Napoleon. That hunk is Nick Effingham. The wave theorist says, no. Nick Effingham is not a hunk of four-dimensional matter. No, Nick Effingham is constituted by a slice of that hunk.
Yeah.
When a bit becomes present, so it's going to be a tense theory. When a slice becomes present, when like God's attention shines down upon it,
yeah,
the illuminated chunk of that hunk constitutes Nick Effingham in exactly the same way that the lump of clay constitutes a statue. So you got hunks constituting Nick Effingham, hunks that used to constitute Napoleon. You've got lumps of clay constituting statues. It's meant to be an analog.
Yeah.
So it sounds very Eternalist, but it's not Eternalism, because Eternalism says that things from the past, present, and future all exist. And we go, well, that means Napoleon exists. And on wave theory, Napoleon doesn't exist. He used to exist. And there's a hunk. It's Napoleon-shaped, right? It looks a lot like Napoleon, but the lump of clay looks a lot like a statue, but it isn't a statue. The hunk of four-dimensional matter looks a lot like Napoleon, but it's not Napoleon. It used to constitute it. Doesn't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Napoleon doesn't exist, so Eternalism is technically false.
Okay. So Napoleon doesn't exist because we're saying that, Napoleon is constituted by like a temporal time slice.
Yeah.
Matter in a temporal time slice. And so like, he doesn't exist. But then you say, well, he doesn't exist today because there is no temporal slice that is constituting Napoleon today. But is the past still actual in a sense? Like is he still doing his thing?
No. So the past is still actual, but Napoleon is no longer in it. The hunk is.
Okay.
It's almost as if God has decided there are no statues anymore. And you go, what? And he's left behind the lump of clay, but he's removed the statue.
Yeah.
Which we could imagine. We might think that for a lump of clay to be a statue, we might think that depends upon us. You need people like you and me to appreciate it and to think about it. And actually, in a world where there were no humans to think about and make statues, there would be no statues. There would just be lumps of clay.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like that.
Well, so if God said there's no more statues in the past, it seems like the form of the statue would like leave the clay, right? Like, so you wouldn't have Goliath anymore. It would like morph down into whatever, right? Like, wouldn't that be the case? Or could we say like, no, that could the, just the mere act of God saying there are no statues mean there's no statues, or wouldn't something have to change in reality?
Well, I guess we don't want to take the God metaphor too literally, you know,
sure,
can God
sure.
declare that there's no statues? Presumably not, unless you yeah. think God can do the metaphysically impossible.
Sure, sure.
So let's try a different example. Yeah. Let's try comparing. Let's say that you've got a constitution theorist who believes the following plausible, I'm not saying it's definitely true, but plausible belief. For a lump of clay to be a statue, it's got to be shaped in a certain way.
Uh-huh.
It's got to have a certain arrangement. But it's also got to be the case that there was a sculptor who made it that way.
Yeah.
So if natural forces somehow blew against a cliff and just by chance
right.
made a chunk of stone look exactly like Michelangelo's David, that would not be a statue. That would be a weird lump of stone, but it wouldn't be a statue.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like that. You've got these hunks. And what does it take for this hunk to be a statue? It's nothing to do intrinsically with the hunk.
Yeah.
Don't think about the material makeup of the hunk. It required something to go on elsewhere, in this case, Michelangelo carving it. Mm-hmm. So in my theory, you've got these hunks, you've got these four-dimensional hunks of Napoleon, but it takes more than that to have Napoleon. You need something else. This time it isn't a sculptor. This time it's presentness. It's the metaphysical property of presentness. It's the quality of the present moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I was trying to get at with the God and statues. I understand that can be, we can get us down in the weeds or something, but so if Napoleon is continually, okay, it's not Napoleon technically, because on this view, Napoleon would only exist if he exists in this present moment, if he's constituted in this time slice, and he's not. So there is no Napoleon anymore, but like the past does still exist, and Napoleon has existence simpliciter, maybe, even if he doesn't have present existence.
Oh no! So Napoleon has ceased to exist simpliciter. He used to exist.
Okay,
he did,
okay,
he
but there's a temporal part that is doing the things that Napoleon had once done currently. Well,
that
not
has
current.
The properties that he once had. Yes, yeah, that
okay.
would be true. That would
okay.
be true.
Is there still something that it's like for Napoleon? It's so hard to talk about Napoleon as if he's not Napoleon. The temporal parts of Napoleon back in the past, is there still like qualitative experience going on?
No. So this harks back to an objection we get from moving spotlight theory and going block theory.
Yeah.
So this is kind of where wave theory comes from. I was like, how could you solve these things? So if those theories go in block theory and moving spotlight theory, some people have said, well, look, you've got a problem. You say that back in the past, Napoleon exists. Going block theory says yes. Moving spotlight theory says yes. So imagine Napoleon is saying, it is the present moment. Is he doing that? And you go, yes, he is. Yes, he is. But he's wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's in the past.
Right.
And there seems to be something very weird about that. Because as soon as you admit that Napoleon can be wrong about being present, well, maybe we're wrong about being present. And I mean, this is madness. Like, you shouldn't, like,
and we will be wrong in the future. Yeah, yeah. Like, we will be wrong. Yeah, right, right.
In fact, you're gonna be right for a split second, and then you're gonna be wrong for the rest of eternity.
That's right.
So yeah. You're almost certainly wrong. You're gonna be wrong more times than you like.
Yeah, right.
So that's called the dead past objection or the past thinker's objection, and it's a big problem. It's a big problem, and lots of ink has been spilt on that. Wave theory gets around it by saying, well, Napoleon doesn't exist. And then you're coming back with a very reasonable objection saying, well, hang on, doesn't he have his temporal past still exist? And I'm like, yes, actually, technically it does. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that think? And I go, well, no. Because think about it in terms of constitution theory. So the constitution theorist will say that you've got, let's do it with the statue first, and then let's do it for people. So you have a lump of clay that's statue shaped, and you've got the statue, but they've got different properties. So one of them can survive being crushed, the lump of clay, but not the statue. One of them is aesthetically pleasing, the statue, but not the lump of clay.
Yeah.
One of them is a statue, the statue, not the lump of clay. One of them is a lump, the lump of clay, not the statue. This also works for people. So constitution theorists tend to think that people are examples of constituted objects as well. So you have a lump of organic flesh here, Nick Effingham. Sorry, not Nick Effingham. You've got a lump of organic flesh sat where I am, and it constitutes Nick Effingham. Mm-hmm. So you've got lumps of clay constituting statues. You've got lumps of flesh constituting people like me. And we've got different properties. So I can't survive being crushed, but my body can. I can't survive my heart stopping, but my body can, because it will just become a corpse. It's not so bad for my body for its heart to stop. It kind of hangs down for a lot longer. The maggots have to get at it to get into my body.
Yeah.
But Nick Effingham, he's gone at that point. And they most definitely want to say that the mental properties, the conscious properties, they are only had by the constituted object.
Yeah.
If you prick me, only Nick Effingham is in pain, even if it's his body who bleeds. Like, if that wasn't the case, they'd have a problem. They'd have to say that there were like two thinkers here.
If you punch
Nick Effingham in the face, you've hurt two people. You've hurt Nick Effingham, and you've hurt his body. His body's in pain as well. What did his body ever do to you? So constitution theorists tend to say that mental properties only belong to constituted things. So when we go back to wave theory, you have got a temporal part. It does have the property of neurons firing. It does have the properties of all the different substances in my brain moving in a way which should lead to consciousness, but it's not a person. So it doesn't get conscious. Consciousness belongs to the people that it constitutes, which it no longer does.
So Nick Effingham of like 10 minutes ago is there is no the temple parts that used to constitute you. Is that temporal part of you from 10 minutes ago like a philosophical zombie then? Like there's no qualia going?
I think it's a bit like a philosophical zombie, but only if you want to call my body a philosophical zombie, saying that I'm not. So only if in normal constitution case you want to make kind of difference. Could you call it a philosophical zombie? You could. I don't think it'd be felicitous. I think you'd be misleading someone. If someone wanted a good example of a philosophical zombie, I don't think you should say, "Well, your body." And you're like,
"Sure."
Well, what? I think you'd misled them.
Okay. That's my dualist intuitions are running amok right now. So that might be the problem. This is so fascinating. What is this theory committed to? Like ontological pluralism? Are there different ways to exist?
No, I don't. I think you could be a standard Quine. Certainly, I'm a standard Quine. I do see some attractions of ontological pluralism. But no, I would have thought maybe you want to be an ontological pluralist about constituted entities. If you do, you should be so here. If you don't, you should not be so here. I'm not really sure ontological pluralism helps with constitution. So
okay.
I think you should only be a pluralist about some things if it looks like it'll help you to be a pluralist about those things.
Okay. Yeah, I picked up in one of your papers this distinction between, you know, like present existence and existence simpliciter. And I was wondering if maybe that was doing some work there, but I guess because you're saying because of the constitution view and the temporal slice right now, the present temporal slice, that's what's doing the work. So it's not like Napoleon exists in several different ways. It's like, no, he just doesn't exist anymore because he's not occupying the current temporal slice.
Yeah, that's
okay. How about, so I really like I said, I like a moving spotlight, but it's hard for me to like see a motivation for this temporal moment moving. And again, I like wave theory. What is the temporal like moment? What is that specially attributing identity to you right now, but then it passes away as this moment moves? Like what is that present moment that's moving?
So it sounds like, so I guess there's two questions there. So I think the other one is what makes this instance of time special, metaphysically special?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
I don't think there is an answer to that. I think you could have theories to try to answer that. But I don't think I'll be attracted to that. I think if you're going to be, because remember, if you're a tense theorist, you're saying that it's a fundamental fact. These tense facts are fundamental. And that sounds not the same as, but very similar to, the idea that it's just primitive. It's just inexplicable
right. What
makes the present moment present. So I suspect that there's nothing to that. So that it's, a moment is present, but there's nothing that explains why it's present. It just that it's built into your enterprise that that's just a fact.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this brings us perfectly into like time travel stuff. I think so, at least. Or maybe I'll just try and shoehorn it in. But could I go back and visit Napoleon?
Yeah.
Right. Like, and would it actually be him, or would it be his temporal part? That's on not wave
theory. On wave theory. If you're a wave theorist melding it with time travel, I would probably melt. It depends what theory of time travel you've got.
Okay, cool.
But your standard David Lewis style time travel is that nothing ever changes.
Right.
So what you're describing is that in reality, God sort of watched billions of years of history, and then when he gets to Napoleon, a Nick Effingham time slice steps out of a time machine, and they now have a conversation together. And then it goes forwards, and God's like, "Where's that guy come from?" And obviously, you know, like, maybe an angel's like, "Who's that guy?"
Right,
and then
right.
God's like, "Can't you see? There's a block. There's a hunk that's Nick Effingham shaped later that's going to cause that thing to arrive in the past." But yeah, so I don't think there's any particular problem thrown up by time travel on wave theory. No more so than for any tense theory. So tense theories and time travel. Some people think there's problems there. I don't. I think tell me a theory of time travel. I'll tell you how it's meant to work with tense theory.
Okay. So on the standard Lewis view, I understand like you can't change the past on Lewis's view. You already would have visited him and stuff like that. So you're this Nick Effingham time slice, when it comes to wave theory is tough because it seems like Nick Effingham exists in the present time slice. And the chunk, the temporal part, whatever, is Nick Effingham in that time slice. But if you step out of that time slice to go back to talk to Napoleon, do you cease to be Nick Effingham? Because you're not in the present moment anymore.
I will cease to exist, yeah. No, I'll cease to exist. And then,
okay.
If you're a tense theorist, I think that's something you have to buy into, that if you step into a time machine and never come back, you'll never again exist. But that sounds right. I mean, even the Teslas eternalists will say that that's true. If I get into a time machine and go back and you go, will Nick Effingham exist? Is this the end for him? And they'll go, well, yeah, you know, like that's all she wrote according to the universe.
Yeah.
Admittedly, I will have had, by stepping into the time machine, I will have had more time in the past.
Right. Yeah. So you step back in the past and you come back 5 minutes later. So not at the same moment.
Yeah.
For those 5 minutes, would it be right to say that you don't exist?
That would be exactly correct on wave theory.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't exist in any sense.
Okay. But if we're looking at like from God's perspective, it's like, no, he does exist. I see him. He's moving there. But it's like, because technically you don't. It's your time.
God's perspective, 200 years ago, he remembers seeing Nick Effingham turn up and chat with Napoleon. Once I step into the time machine this time, God won't see me. He saw me 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So he won't see me now. His eyesight, God's like, eyes don't follow me back.
Oh, God's gotcha.
The moving spotlight is moving along the block. God's eyes are moving along the block.
He's so already seen you.
He only sees me appear once back in the past.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. That's really good. I think maybe with the four-dimensionalist view, just the straight up eternalism view, on that view, it's like God's looking at the whole timeline and he would see you pop in and out of different times.
Yes. Yeah. So it's the same thing. Well, which view was that? So
just like straight up like eternalism, it seems like, maybe I'm getting it wrong, but it seems like God's like looking at the timeline.
Yeah.
And he's outside of it.
So eternalist view, yeah, God is like, yes, I can see him there, I can see him there. And there is no question of, you know, where's God's vision trailing along, because that's the tense moving spotlight view. On the tenseless eternalist view, the block theory, the non-moving spotlight eternalist, He just sees a whole lot, and he's like, yep, Nick's there, and he's there, and he's stepping into the time machine there. All makes sense, says God. It all hangs together.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. I want to talk about Exterminus Hypertime for being able to change the past. And I just think the reason that I think we can connect it here is because it seems like on an Eternalist view, if you're going in back in time, you probably can't change the future. So because it's already like happening, right? But it seems like there has to be like a metaphysical time or another type of time, like God's time that he's watching. It doesn't seem like there can be no time. Otherwise, I don't know how you could. So that makes me think of this Exterminus hypertemporal view where there's multiple, at least two different types of time. Can you help us with that?
That's right. Yeah. So in time travel, you've got basically two families of theories. You've got, if you went back in time, you could change the past. Mm-hmm. And if you go back in time, you can't change the past. So David Lewis does, you go back in time, you just can't change the past. Yeah. Then there's a question of, well, what about theories that say I could? What would the world have to be like in order for me to be able to change the past? Mm-hmm. So then there's a proliferation of different theories. So some of them say you can go back in time. I'm sure some of your listeners will be sitting there going, yes, I know what he's about to say. You go back in time and you end up in a different universe. You make a different universe. And it's in that universe that you kill your grandfather or what have you and change the past. Along similar lines, people have this sort of idea that there's different dimensions of time. So we've got normal time, and then we've got hyper time. And that will somehow play a role in explaining how the past changes. And I think what I call Exterminus hypertime is the most natural way. It's not the way that most philosophers have gone for, actually. So I think it's the most natural way of understanding this picture, but not the one that people opted for.
Yeah.
And on this view, time just straightforwardly has two dimensions. Mm-hmm. So space has got three dimensions, up, down, forwards, backwards, left, right. On the two-dimensional view of time, time's got two dimensions. It's got the normal one you're acquainted with, earlier than and later than. But you can go along this axis as well if you want, and that's hyper earlier and hyper later.
Yeah.
And what happens when time travel is you move forwards in hyper time to a universe that is exactly identical up until that point, and then you start messing things around in that hyper time. Yeah. So if now is hyper time one. So it's time, it's the year 2022 in time, but it's hyper time one. I would use my time machine to go back to 1930 to kill Hitler. Mm-hmm. And I'd arrive at hyper time two. And at hyper time two, I kill Hitler and the future's totally different. And it's all lovely and swimming. I know that it won't be because that's what all the time travel movies tell us. If you change time, but let's imagine it goes swimmingly. And it's a wonderful utopia. And there's no contradiction because all you've done is, like, Hitler's alive here and dead there. And I mean, that's not so weird, is it? You know?
Right.
Hitler's alive in 1930 and dead in 2022. Yeah. So it's exactly the same thing, except now he's alive in 1930 at hypertime one and dead in 1930 at hypertime two. And that's a model of time travel whereby we could change the past.
So someone might quibble and say, well, you're not technically changing the past because you've created a hypertime two, which is it a discrete whole universe?
Yeah, it's a discrete whole universe. Although we don't want to say we created it. We don't want to, it always would have been there. It always would have been there anyway. I just went to it.
And in that world that always would have been there, would you always have gone and killed Hitler?
Tricky. So now we've got always, but we've got three senses of always. We've got always at all times,
yeah.
Always, hyper always at all hyper times. And then we've got like a tenseless always, just like ignore time, just take the God's eye view of this whole shebang.
Yeah.
What would happen? In the God's eye view of the whole shebang, yeah, God would be like, yes, it's always been the case that there's hyper time T1, and there's always a case that Nick, from God's point of view, it was always the case. So if we mean a tenseless always, it's always the case.
Okay. Does that add a third dimension then of time?
I'm going to say no, but I'll pass that back. This has, I'll then say this has nothing to do with time travel. This is all to do with just that eternalist presentist debate. So imagine we're doing eternalism and you say, so you were, you know, we're having this conversation now in 2022. Was it always the case that we're having the conversation in 2022? And we go, well, look, there's a few ways of making sense of that.
Yeah.
One is, were we always having a conversation? It's like, well, no, like in 1984, we weren't having a conversation. So it's not always the case.
Yeah.
But then you might go, no, I meant it in like a tenseless sense, from God's eye view, from God's eye view. Were you and I always having this conversation in 2022? And from that God's eye, tenseless view, we were. So if you're comfortable with that God's eye view talk, which I am, if you're comfortable with that talk, we should be comfortable with it even when there's two dimensions of time.
Okay.
If you're uncomfortable with that talk, well, then don't ask me questions like, was it always the case that Nick went back in time and killed Hitler? You're uncomfortable with that talk. This is a you problem, not a me problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't feel like I've answered your question about, is this earlier change? So I can see what you're getting at there.
Yeah.
So I go back and I kill Hitler, and someone says, well, you haven't really changed anything because Hitler's still alive in hypertime T1. What have you really changed? And my answer to that, I go into that in my monograph, is to say that this is change. The change, imagine you stick your hand on the stove. So it's time one, and then you stick your hand on the stove, it's time T2, mm-hmm. and you move your hand off it. And I go, why did you do that? You went, I wanted to stop being in pain. And I go, well, that's nonsense. You're still in pain at time T2. You've indelibly scarred reality with your pain at time T2. And you're looking at me going, I still really want to take my hand off this stove, Nick. You know,
right.
If that isn't change, that's fine, but it's change good enough for me. When we in English, when in natural language, we talk about change, it counts as change, even if you haven't changed reality by moving your hand. You're still in pain at time T2. So it's the same thing on hypertime. So I go back and kill Hitler, and someone says, well, you've not really changed the past. And I go, well, like, I've changed it as much as taking my hand off the stove changed me from being in pain to not. I think that's a kind of change. I think that's the kind of change we're looking for.
Yeah.
So.
Well, so I think about like the ethics of one of my guests brought this up to me, and I can't remember who, but maybe like the ethics of like exercise now, because I can go exercise really hard and I think this is horrible. I hate this. I feel like I'm going to die, but it's going to be worth it in the future. But if this theory is, well, if certain theories of the ontology of time are true, then like I'm committing a time slice of me, even though it wouldn't be me on your view, I'm committing a temporal part to like eternal agony of working out. And it's like, dude, there is qualia there, right? There is that the pain state of that person, but it's not a person. There's something there experiencing that pain forever, right?
It's called a personite in the literature.
Personite, so
those temporal parts of you that seem to be people, if not for the fact that they were part of you. If only, you know, if only you died at the end of the exercise, it would have been a person. But fortunately, you didn't. That's good for you.
Right.
But that means that it's not a person. But people are worried that nevertheless, it still gets to be conscious and have beliefs and desires and it suffers. So you're just making the poor personite suffer. And it gets nothing. You get.
I know. Yeah.
You get the chiseled body.
That's right.
And it gets nothing.
Right.
So, well, that's unfair.
Just fat and sad in the past,
and of course it never realizes it. On the upside, it never discovers. It thinks it's going to get the chiseled body.
Okay,
It's just really sad for it. This is a problem. This is a problem in the literature. I don't know what to say about these personites. I don't know what to say about personites.
I
think they're a big problem. I'm really interested in the personite debate, and I'm yet to see a decent answer to the personite debate that does it for me. Presumably there is one, because we don't want to actually accept that I shouldn't go and get my tooth fixed, or that I shouldn't exercise, or that I shouldn't go to work because it's dull for me, but I get money. Whereas my personite is like a slave who suffers. Have you ever seen the show Severance on
Severance, amazing show, yeah.
When I was watching it, I was sitting there going, this is personite. This is exactly what a personite is.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, there's like the question of what you owe yourself, I guess, or whatever. And maybe you could say like, yeah, I even if I accept this, I'm okay with this personite right here. I'm me. I'm this will be a personite. And yeah, at least he gets to like feel good that he is helping me, even though he is helping the other personites that will, you know, slough off or be part of that causal chain or something. But I wonder about like the moral status of a personite, whether they are full, because they're not persons, so maybe they don't have the full, but maybe we say like, yeah, the personite enjoys the same level of moral status that a person does. Does that sound right?
I think that's ultimately the conclusion we want to reach, is that for some reason, the personite does not have the moral status of a person.
Okay.
And so needn't be taken into account. Absolutely. That's where we want to end up. But the philosophical question is, well, why? What is it about them? What is it about them? And when we say that it simply is lacking the feature of being a person, that sounds a bit worrying. It sounds like there should be more to moral status than a mere sortal term. So as a person, that is just a sortal term. There should be something about you. Like your, you know, we might think, imagine you eat meat. You might eat meat. I eat meat. I used to be a vegetarian for years. Now I'm not.
Oh, wow.
So you people won't eat a cow. We'll think that maybe the cow suffers and feels pain, but they think that it doesn't count as a person, so they can eat it. They should at least acknowledge that there's some pressure to explain what's going on there. Maybe we think that the cow's mental life isn't as sophisticated. Maybe we think cows don't have qualia. Maybe we think the cows don't have beliefs and desires, and beliefs and desires are important to something. So that's I don't believe that a cow suffers by being killed because it hasn't got any desires or beliefs that would lead it to suffer from being killed. Huh. Not that that's got anything to do with why I eat meat nowadays, but let's not get pulled into that. You don't want to talk to that division about ethics. You know, be like inviting me on your show to go, this is how I fix your kitchen sink. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not an expert in that. I should keep to the topic. I'm not.
Yeah. So good.
It's incumbent upon people who eat meat, I think, to explain why it is they get to stick cows in sheds and raise them and then kill them. Because you can't do that to Bob and John and Jill, right? So what's the difference? And people who do turn around and say, well, the difference is that, you know, we're humans and they're animals. And sitting there going, well, that's not the difference. That can't be the difference. Mm-hmm. It seems prima facie implausible to me that a sortal difference could make a difference. Yeah,
right.
I meet E.T., or we meet the Klingons and the Vulcans, and I'm like, oh, I've always wanted to chow down on one of them. You'd be horrified. You'd be absolutely mortified. Right. And I'm sitting there going, oh, they're not humans, though. No, they're not. You can't eat them. Yeah. You meet an angel, and you're just like, well, we've checked with our moral community. It's only humans, mate.
Right.
These angels are running away, going, stay away from these guys. They're lunatics. So it's the same thing for personites. It can't be a mere sortal difference. It can't be merely that they're persons, not persons. It has to be something else. I mean, one thing, of course, is they just don't exist. So we try and figure out a way to not include them in our ontology.
Yeah. Well, so I think about the time travel case. If I do go back and I'm like, well, I guess technically I'm a personite because I'm not occupying the present temporal slice, but like neither are any of these other folks. So like I can just do whatever because they're personites. They're not persons, right?
Yeah, I think it'd still be a bit. It turned out the personhood would stretch across hyper times.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I like that. I want to jump back on that, but real quick, I wonder about saying at least on like the wave theory. Is it right to say that you used to eat meat, or is that like a folk way of understanding it? And like, if we want to be technical, my person,
I used to eat meat. Yeah,
you could say, you could talk. Yeah. But you exist in this present moment. You're constitute. Like, how do we speak about our former self, I guess, with.
I think we just do that in the same way that the presentist would do it. So you just. Okay. You just talk about the facts that were the case. We've got these fun. There'll be something that tells us, because I guess I don't think those past facts are fundamental. I think they're derivative, but There's facts like it was the case of Nick Effingham ate meat. What makes it true for me? Well, what makes it true on my theory is that there's a hunk and it's got disentangled parts, and one of those temple parts is present and constitutes me. But one of those temple parts is back in the past. But it's still got certain qualities. And those qualities are such that if only it were present, it would constitute Nick Effingham. And the Nick Effingham it would constitute would be happy or sad or a vegetarian. Okay. So what makes it true that it used to be the case in Nick Effingham ate meat are just facts about these hunks back in the past.
Okay, that's chunks. Good. Yeah, chunks. You always say chunks. So going back on to...
clarify, because I might have thought. So I guess that is actually, thinking about it now, that is different from what the presentist would say. I guess right. That's definitely different from what the presentist would say. I'm sticking with what I've just said.
And I think that it has more explanatory power, maybe. And I know presentists will be able to, they have ways of describing their past selves. But in this one, there are still like, there are still truth makers back there. But in a presentist, there are none. So they have to say something else.
That is one of the selling points of wave theory. So
yeah,
why should you? If you're that's kind of the published paper I've currently got on this says that's the argument. It goes through the tense theorists and says if you believe this tense theory, you should believe my tense theory instead. Yeah. If you believe presentism, it's got a truth making problem. Have you thought of being a wave theorist?
Yeah.
If you're moving spotlight theorist or going block theorist, you've got this problem of dead past thinking and Napoleon thinking that he's present. We thought being a wave theorist. So that's what the existing paper says about that.
Yeah, I really like
I'm hoping that. To add this. I'm writing a book on it, actually, on wave theory at the moment, and I'm hoping to add a bit more to the mix. But during the writing of that book, I'm starting to think that I don't know of any good argument to be a tensor theorist or tensor theorist. I can only sort of turn up and go, if you believe this theory, have you thought being a wave theorist?
Yeah, that's really good. So just briefly, a couple minutes ago, you mentioned that, maybe the personhood follows the time traveler back through hypertime. So would that give, so if I went back in time, and the personhood followed me, am I a person amongst personites?
You're gonna have to run me through that one. You'll have to explain that again. So I leave 2022 and go back to kill Hitler in 1930. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would still, if there were personites in a normal case, there'd still be personites in this case. Mm-hmm. But I would still be a person. It's just that I'd kind of stretch across the hyper times.
Yeah. Does that sound right?
That sounds like, there'd still be personites, yeah.
Okay.
If you believe in personites in the normal case.
Right. Right. So then we'd have to know what to say about personites and whether they have the moral status of persons. Because if not, then maybe you could just run roughshod over everyone, and they're less. Maybe they'd still have some kind of status, I guess.
I think these debates might be orthogonal to one another. So there are these questions about personites and the very pressing questions.
Right.
But I don't think they combine so much with the time travel, because in the same way that. So I'm going to go out this evening and meet some people. If I sat there and thought to myself, maybe you're just mere personites. I just, started taking their wallets and pushing them out of the way. I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But the philosophical explanations for why you shouldn't do that would apply even in the time travel cases.
Oh, okay.
I don't think time travel is really twisting or changing that debate in any.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know in case any time travelers are in our midst.
Yes, you get what I'm going.
So, what was that? I missed that one.
Who knows what they might do to us?
Yeah, right, exactly. So going back to the hyper time view on exterminus, hyper temporal worlds, we've got world one where Hitler did everything he did, we got world two where Nick Effingham went back and killed Hitler. Mm-hmm. If let's say, let me think, who would want to, some neo-Nazi wants to stop you from killing Hitler. So he also travels to stop you from creating Hypertime 2, would that create a Hypertime 3, or would that just modify Hypertime 2?
Okay. So this is where it starts to get a little bit tricky. So these views where you go back in time, they do have this problem. That if two time travelers leave the same universe or leave the same hypertime and travel back to different times, then what on earth happens? It's easy if they go to the same time. Yeah. So if the neo-Nazi leaves and tries to come back to exactly the same instance in 1930, I guess we both are alive and we duke it out. Yeah. Movie style. But obviously in most movies, that's not what happens. Mm-hmm. What happens in most movies is one guy goes back and the other one's like, I must go back and stop him. And they're alive a few minutes later. And that's a huge problem for these views. If it's universes, this is fine. What we say is that they're each alive in their own universe. Okay. So if I leave to 1930 to go and kill Hitler, and then the neo-Nazi leaves to 1929, the neo-Nazi ends up in a totally different universe than me, and I end up in a totally universe, and we'll miss one another. He'll be expecting to see me, but I'm not going to be there. He'll be like, well, hang on, what's, you know, why not? Where's Nick Effingham? He's like, nope, there's no Nick Effingham in your universe. You've missed him.
Yeah.
And this actually caused, I did a paper 2012, and it turns out that this means that if you go back in, say you've got a portal or wormhole, and you go through it over a period of time, well, that means that different bits of you are going to end up in different universes.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll be sliced. You'll be sliced. So I'll be like, I'm going to go back in time now. No, I'm about to dice myself into an infinite number of slices spread across an infinite number of universes. Big problem. Big problem.
Yeah.
When I say it's a problem, I mean, we are discussing how the world would be if these theories were true.
Right.
So not so much a problem. It's just like, well, like, if that's how the world is, I guess that's what would happen. Don't use a time machine under those circumstances.
Right.
It gets harder with hypertime because universes aren't ordered. So okay. I've explained how it works on universes. I've said, I know what would happen. I have the answer. It goes badly for you. Nazi in the Disney universe and me. I get sliced into portions if I travel through a time door. But that's because universes aren't ordered. And because hypertimes are ordered, we get a huge problem. We get a huge problem. And it's difficult to see what to say about that. In the paper I've got on Exterminus Hypertime, I do discuss a solution, which is that if it takes a length of time for time to change, we can all go to the next hypertime. So the neo-Nazi would end up at hypertime 2, and I would end up at hypertime 2. But not Hitler wouldn't die at hypertime 2. It'd take a while in hypertime for Hitler to die in hypertime 2, and it'd take a while for the Nazi to change time. I won't lie, it's a long, complicated story. Which is actually why the paper exists, because I was lying, it was during COVID, I was watching a time travel movie, as I do, going, actually, because I've done this as a problem, so I posed it as a problem, and I was like, actually, maybe you could make this work. Maybe here's a solution. But the solution was long and interminable and complicated, and I was like, how am I ever going to get this published? And then my friend said, I'm doing a time travel special issue. I was like, excellent. I've had an idea for a paper. I mean, it is of niche interest, shall we say. So it's a long, complicated story. If anyone's interested, they should probably, unfortunately, have to leave the paper. Don't think, without a whiteboard and another half hour, I don't think I could explain it.
Right.
Yeah.
I know several of my audience members are going to have to track that down. If Taylor Sear is listening and he hasn't already checked that out, I'm sure he will. He loves that stuff. I don't know if it'd be worth broaching the problem of overdetermination for this view. You know, if there are hypercausal connections between time hypertimes,
these causal connections. I think on this view you need there to be these causal connections. So the idea is that in our universe, in a one-dimensional temporal universe, what goes on at the earlier instant causes the universe to be a certain way at the next instant. So. Mm-hmm. Even if we stop doing anything, we just, you know, lay still, our bodies would still cause it to be another time slice of Nick Effingham at the next instant.
Yeah.
And I think exactly the same thing goes on with hypertime, externus hypertime. Okay. How the next slice is, how the next hypertime is caused by the earlier time. So eventually, if you stop time traveling, if you get to a hypertime where no one time travels back in time, then all of the rest of the hypertimes will be exact duplicates of that, caused to be that way. In the same way that if this universe just throws in amber for eternity, it would be the same way.
Yeah.
So you're kind of freezing in amber, but in hypertime, you're making the rest of hypertime exactly the same way.
Okay.
You need these hypercausal connections.
Yeah. Is there a fundamental hypertime that all the rest are based off of?
Is there like a first hypertime?
Yeah. Maybe that's right. Yeah.
Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. So This again would be like, well, what do you say in a normal one-dimensional time case? So In a normal world of one-dimensional time, do you think there must be a first instant? If so, I guess it's going to be a first hyper instant. But many people go, no, there does not have to have been a first instant. Maybe time has just lasted forever and there's not a first way that time can be. Well, in that case, if that's true, well, then hypertime doesn't need a first instant.
Yeah, that's good. I'm thinking of like, you know, William Lane Craig listening to this and coming up with a new Kalam cosmological argument for hyper times or something.
I mean, it would work exactly the same way. If you're moved by the Kalam cosmological argument to believe that there's a first instance of time, you should believe there's a first instance of hyper time. I can't see why you'd have a disparity there.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
But there's then a problem of overdetermination, as you say.
What do you make of that? Is it just, you know, like, so what? Like, yeah, maybe it's kind of weird, but you talked about it in the paper, and I just don't know enough to. And it was a really good reply, but I can't do it myself.
Let me recall. Sometimes I have to recall exactly what the argument is. So, the idea is that overdetermination is only surprising when the laws of nature don't determine it.
Right.
So overdetermination that is caused by the laws of nature, that can go on. So in this particular situation I'm describing, it would be overdetermined. Why is my grandfather as he is in 1930 at hypertime 2? Well, it is because of how he was in 1929 at hypertime 2, but it's also because of how he was in 1930 at hypertime T1. So it does get overdetermined, but it's not a problem. Because the laws of nature are doing the overdetermining. It's okay if the laws of nature determine things to be that way.
Yeah. Does that also incorporate or like necessitate or imply whatever backwards causation from the 1930 to the 1929?
So it should always be forwards.
Okay.
If you're at a hypertime, if you remain in your hypertime, causation only ever goes forwards.
Okay.
And in hypertime, causation only ever goes forwards in that direction.
Okay.
There's only backwards causation insofar as something at a later time at one hyper time can cause something in an earlier time at a late hyper later time.
This is so good.
And that's not really a backwards causation. I wouldn't call that backwards causation.
Okay.
You
cool.
can develop models where you can go back in hyper time. And I do talk about them in another paper. Okay. And that gets super weird. Why would you care about those models? It makes sense of certain time travel fictions. All of this for me is an explanation. Not all of this, not all of time travel, but the externus hypertime, the idea that time's got two dimensions. I mean, time does not have two dimensions. So even if time travel is physically possible, I am not describing to you how it works. Like, if you got a time machine and you could go back in time and kill Hitler, I would be very surprised. I would be dumbfounded. I'd be like, I guess that's how the world could have been. I'm very surprised to discover that that's how the world is.
Yeah.
But I am interested in just what's possible and thinking, looking at time travel movies and looking at time travel TV and going, no matter how weird a world, can I make a really weird world with like five dimensions of time where this all makes sense? And sometimes I go, yes, you can. I try and get a paper out of that.
It's so good. That was the last question I wanted to ask you was, you walked right into it here. You mentioned in several papers, or maybe just one, you mentioned somewhere that, look, the philosopher is talking about the possibilities going on. Whereas like it's the physicist there, it's their job, to go and like tell us whether this is physically possible in this world or something. So with that in mind, what do you make of it? Like, do you think that time travel is possible for us to do?
Physically?
Yes. Physically.
Yes. No. Actually, let's... Up until... So this spurs on something that... Let me start again. My book, so the book I've written, argues that if you've got a David Lewis view of time travel, which I think I do, insofar as if I think time travel is physically possible, I imagine it would work in the Lewis style sense. Could be long. Yeah. I'm not a physicist. Some physicists have written papers arguing that it works in a different way. And I'm not begrudging them. But if you ask me, I know, ask me to make a decision about physics, I guess I'd make this decision. And if it works in a David Lewis way, then time travel is so weird, you would struggle to get your head around it. But you can. And the weird thing about it is that even if it was physically possible, you're still never going to do it. The chance that you should award to it of happening is zero, even if it's physically possible, even if it is in some sense fairly easy. So imagine that the laws of physics were such that mixing some household goods that are readily available creates a magic potion that allows you to travel in time.
I
think that world is logically possible. If you lived in that world, you should expect no one to do it. You should expect no one to do it. So if the physicist figured it out, you should expect anyone who tried to make the potion to die or fail to drink it or to go long. And so no one will ever time travel back. And that works even in our universe. So even if time travel is physically possible, I would expect it to never, ever take place.
Is that because
explanation for that is quite tricky. So I don't know. I could go into that. I could go into explaining that and be quite happy to. But then feeds into your question was, do I think time travel is physically possible? Is that I think it is more likely to be physically possible than the physicists currently believe. Because some of what the physicists do is an experiment or an expectation that the reality would be a certain way. So they, you know, why do they think time travel is not possible? They go, well, time travelers would come back and spoken to us. Yeah. They've conducted experiments to see if there's faster than light particles. And they've gone, we would expect to see these particles over here. And they've looked and they're not there. So this is all part of the case for physicists to think that time travel is not, in fact, possible. Whereas, if you're Nick Effingham, I go, no, the laws of physics might allow time travel. You should still not expect to see these things.
Yeah.
And that's weird. I guess I know I'm saying something weird because someone's like, if it's possible, why should you expect it never to happen? Aren't those two things the same? But those two things are not the same.
Right.
Something can be possible and... for you to have a chance zero of it happening. They're definitely compatible claims.
Yeah. Can I ask you just like, can we flesh it out just a little bit? Like why would we?
Which claim do you want? That something can have a chance of zero and be possible?
Not that one. That one's really fascinating, but I'm like stuck. Yeah. The reason why we would expect it not to happen.
First thing we need to get our head around is that the weird thing that goes on in time travel cases where you can't change the past is the probability starts getting really funky. Okay. So imagine I'm in good health, and I'm a great shot, and I've gone back in time to shoot Hitler. Right. So I've got the gun pointing at Hitler, and I'm about to pull the trigger, and I go, should I do this? And you go, no, Nick, you shouldn't, because we know that you're going to fail for certain. You are not going to kill Hitler. So, Nick, you've got a problem. Is that whilst normally you only have a 1 in 100 chance of having a heart attack, and you only have a 1 in 100 chance of missing when you pull the trigger of your rifle, I know for certain that one of those two things is going to happen. So normally, if all those people you tried to murder in 2022, Nick, when you've been there watching me kill dictators, normally, I've gone, is this a good idea? And you've gone, yeah, shoot the dictator. And I pull the trigger and they die and I don't miss and I don't have a heart attack because it's so unlikely because I'm in good health. I'm a good shot. But once I've gone back in time, once I'm back in time and I'm pointing a Hitler, totally different ball game. You're going, Nick, we know for certain you're either going to miss or you're going to have a heart attack, which causes you to fail to pull the trigger. And the chance of those, let's stipulate, is exactly the same. So the chance of you having a heart attack if you try and pull that trigger is 50-50. So in a normal case, it's 1 in 100. That actually be a ridiculously high chance of a heart attack. But let's go with the numbers.
Yeah.
In a normal case in 2022, it's 1 in 100. But now you're pointing your gun at Hitler, Nick, it's 50-50.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Yeah.
So these probabilities change because you're caught in a causal loop, because you're caught in a time loop. Because you know Hitler did not die, because Hitler did not die, the probabilities change in the past.
Yeah.
And this works even though we don't need some like weird physical particle. It's not that Hitler starts like exuding heart attack radiation that causes him to have a heart attack. That's not what's going on. There's no physical mechanism. There's no physical mechanism that causes it. So that's the take-home message. In a time travel case, like David Lewis says, probability works early differently. And it works early differently without there being a physical mechanism to bring it about. It's all done by the David Lewis time travel model. And once you accept that, you see that this would apply even before I get into the time machine. So I'm about to step into the time machine. And you go, well, actually, Nick, your chance of having a heart attack is going up right now because you're stepping into the time machine, intending to go back to kill Hitler. Something's going to stop you. It doesn't necessarily follow that the thing that stops me is when I'm about to kill Hitler. What might stop me is stepping into the time machine. What might stop me is something that goes on in 2022.
Yeah.
And it gets even weirder. Imagine I'm planning to build a time machine. And if I build it, I'm definitely going to kill Hitler.
Yeah.
Well, if it's actually the case that I might succeed, my chance of a heart attack is going up.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine I'm going to have a grandchild or great grandchild. If only, you know, I manage to go down the aisle with my fiance, then I'll have I'll eventually have a descendant who will make a time machine to go back in time and kill Hitler. Well, turns out my chance of having a heart attack has just gone up and you're like, I haven't done anything. It's like, no, you haven't done anything, but When we do the numbers, it turns out your chance of a heart attack has gone.
Yeah.
Any amount of going back in time, I think, would bring about a paradox. So we go, could you go back in time and just try and avoid killing Hitler? And I go, that's not good enough. Because when you go back in time, your gravitational field will shift a particle from being here to being there, which is, from the universe's point of view, just as much of a contradiction as Hitler being dead or alive. The universe will suffer no contradictions. The universe won't... Reality doesn't allow for Hitler to be both dead and alive in 1930.
Right.
Equally, it doesn't allow for a particle to be here as well as microscopically one micron to the light. And if I go back in time, I will disturb reality and I'll start... So I will almost certainly, to a chance of almost one, I will almost certainly jostle the atoms in a way that is logically inconsistent. So as I'm about to go back into my time machine to have a quick peek in 1930 and do no harm, I'm almost certainly going to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
And if you have like if the governments of the world funded a massive experiment to do time travel, it's almost certainly going to fail.
Wow. In the Lewis style, I think you make this is a really compelling case, but I'm thinking about there was almost a nuclear holocaust in like the 50s. But what if that didn't take place because someone in 2025 went back in time and talked to the leaders? Like it already would have happened. And so if you're the time traveler and you're thinking like, I think I have to go back and make sure that the nuclear holocaust doesn't happen. That would be like a different case than like killing Hitler, where you know Hitler didn't die in those times, but you're like trying to make sure that something that has already happened does happen. Right.
So
you're assuming you've already done it, right? Like maybe
I have this time. As soon as you build in the assumption that you've already done it,
yeah,
you're going to get a different answer out on the probability. So,
okay.
What's my chance of winning the lottery? Very, very, very low. Mm-hmm. What's the chance of me having the winning numbers assuming I win the lottery? Very, very high. But when you build in the assumption,
yeah,
that would make a difference to the unconditional probability that we're genuinely interested in. So if you knew you were in a situation where the Holocaust was stopped in the 1950s by a time traveler, then absolutely expect some time travel to happen. But obviously so. You built it in. You built it into the assumption. You said, you know, assume time travel's happened. Should you expect time travel to happen? I'm like, well yeah, if I know. And I do want to say that these things are possible. There's possible permutations of reality that lead to time travel. Okay. I just think they're so unlikely.
Yeah.
They're so unlikely.
It's like a warning for anyone working on time travel right now. Watch.
Well, my book, that is exactly what my book says. We shouldn't work on time. You know, you should not try and do a time travel experiment. And people have, and they haven't worked because they weren't very plausible. But, you know, you shouldn't even try, because either it's going to fail, in which case you shouldn't have bothered, or you might succeed, in which case, like, very bad things might happen.
Yeah, that's amazing, because it seems to me like so rare for someone to say, like, even if we can do this, don't do it, you know, our world, like in the AI conversations and stuff. It's like, well, no, it's a race. Like, we're capitalists. So naturally it's going to happen. Like, well, maybe we just shouldn't, though. Maybe you just don't do that. Or maybe we should tell them to start working on time travel with their AI so that we can just get rid of all of them as they're doing. Well,
might get rid of us. You know, there might be an asteroid on its way.
That's bad. Well, Dr. Effingham, this has been awesome, and this is you've expanded my mind. I'm gonna have to chew on this some more. You have so much other stuff too, like the just on different topics like fission and Adam and original sin. I'd love to have you back on that, so maybe I can coax you into coming back on.
Other time. This has been a blast. I'd love to talk to you. That'd be
awesome.
Great. Yeah,
well, so before I let you go here, is there anywhere that you'd want to point listeners to if they want to get involved or they want to read more of your work or listen to you or something like that?
So virtually all of my work is on my website, which is a Weebly. So just stick in Nick Effingham Weebly. Just stick in Nick Effingham and it should pop up. I think virtually all of my work is publicly accessible. So if anyone wants to read it, they should be able to read almost all of it other than the monograph on time travel. Unfortunately, that's not publicly accessible. And I think that's it. There's links on my webpage to all kinds of talks of me talking about all kinds of different things.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. Well, folks, that's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.